Think on your feet for our Fast and Curious 5K, a one-of-a-kind race hosted by WBEZ and the Chicago Sun-Times on Saturday, July 27th at Humboldt Park. More info and early bird registration at wbez.org/events.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. This week felt long, but we officially made it to Friday, so it's time to dive into our weekly news recap, where we cover the top stories that you need to know about, but that you might have missed. From the attempt to oust a Southwest Side alderman from his post chairing a city council's housing committee.
Alderman Byron Sixto Lopez will not be punished amid a flag-burning scandal in the city council.
To alders pushing to be able to decide the fate of a controversial gunshot detection system.
The Public Safety Committee approved an order empowering the local alders to help decide whether or not to keep ShotSpotter in their ward.
And a few firsts for the city.
Mayor Brendan Johnson has announced Cindy Soto as Chicago's first ever chief homelessness officer.
And
Mayor Brendan Johnson appoints the city's first ever Latina chief of staff.
We've got a star panel this week. Brandis Friedman is co-anchor of WTTW's Chicago Tonight and host of Chicago Tonight Black Voices. David Greising is president of the Better Government Association. And Quinn Myers covers Wicker Park, Bucktown, and Westtown, as well as city council for Block Club Chicago. Quinn starts off by telling us about Cristina Pasiones Zayas, Mayor Johnson's new chief of staff.
So Rich Guidus, his first chief of staff, retired. He was a pretty experienced city official. He has gone back, I think, into like the early 90s working in the city. He retired on Monday, and Cristina Pasiones Zayas, his deputy chief of staff, has assumed the role. For anyone who pays close attention to local politics, though, she is not a new name. She was a state senator, and before that was pretty, vocal about issues in Humboldt Park, Logan Square, where she lives, and I think grew up, and also, was a voice on education, worked in the Erickson Institute, if I'm correct there. So she is, and as you mentioned in your clip, she is the first Latina to be a chief of staff for the mayor.
Yeah.
But she's definitely someone who is, I think, on the Brandon Johnson team or on the campaign of sorts, whereas Rich Guidus, I don't think was necessarily as much of that person. So it's going to be interesting to see what changes or what doesn't at City Hall.
Brandis and David, I mean, is this signaling Johnson's continued commitment to his progressive agenda?
I would say yes. And the and part is he was also seen, Guidus was seen as a connection to kind of the establishment power structure in the city of Chicago, business community and others. He had worked closely with, say, the business community because he was in charge of the NATO meeting in Chicago, the Obama Grand Park celebration, et cetera. And so it's a loss for the mayor in terms of being able to connect with constituencies where his connections, I think, are somewhat still in development. Let's put it that way.
Well, she was in charge of the city's response to the migrant crisis, Brandis, although the Johnson administration's really come under a lot of criticism. I think clearly this states that the mayor's happy with how she handled it.
Apparently. I mean, it sounds like an endorsement of how she's handled that. The city is probably going to continue to take some criticism over this either way,
I think.
And I wonder to some degree if that was always the plan, because the way my colleague Heather Sharon is reporting it is that, Guidus and Cristina Pasiones Zayas were sort of a package deal at the beginning. And is this seen as sort of a taking the training wheels off a little bit, right? Like Guidus had all of that experience. And now, the big mayor and his team are ready to kind of roll on their own, and also a reflection of him sort of doubling down on what we know to be his progressive agenda, despite how it's already gone for him over the last year.
And I do think Pasiones Zayas, or CPZ as the politicos call her, is well respected by a lot of people, and especially I think has ties to Governor J.B. Pritzker, having worked in the Senate. So I do think people genuinely like her and think she's very competent. So we'll see what happens.
Right. You think the mayor thinks that those Springfield relationships might come in handy?
Well, certainly. And he can use some help in that regard. He's a bit at issue with the governor on a number of different concerns. And to have that kind of connection is valuable. He could use more of that going forward.
Yeah. Mayor Johnson also named Cindy Soto the city's first ever chief homelessness officer. David, what do we know about her and what this new role might actually involve?
Well, she comes most recently from the Chicago Community Trust, which over the last number of years has really been focusing on issues like the wealth gap as well as bringing more resources to overlooked communities. And so this is sort of a natural transition, playing on an area in which she has considerable expertise. Creating this new chief homelessness officer position is a real statement on the part of Mayor Johnson. He really is focused on homelessness as an issue, as we've seen.
Yeah.
You know, he lost the Bring Chicago Home referendum, obviously, but he right away came back with this $1.25 billion program of homelessness-related investment, et cetera. This is going to be a signature issue of his term here, and to put somebody with Sandy Soto's background and competency up against it is
important.
Yeah,
former official with
statement.
The city's Department of Housing.
Well, based on her resume, she looks like she's really well suited for this. And the trust over the last number of years, that has been like a real area of focus. And they've done some really important work. So it seems like it should be a pretty effective appointment.
And now we're just looking at specifics. What will she do? And post Bring Chicago Home, where, you know, the mayor had expected or hoped to get $100 million annually, possibly from that, you know, what is a specific plan and where is some of that money going to come from, possibly from the bond deal? Although that's also, I think, a wider development agenda there as well.
Some of the language in that job description looked a little vague to me, so remains to be seen.
Mm-hmm. Gives them options going forward.
What will actually be done.
Right.
It's always, I think, good, though, to be the first of any position, right? Because then you can sort of make it into what you want.
It seems to me like it might be more challenging, right? Like nobody has ever, you know, written or done this job before.
True.
And so in a way, you've got the power to kind of make it what you want, but you also have the challenge. Nobody knows what you're doing yet because
so
nobody's
can they
seen
criticize you,
do you it,
just
right?
yet?
Right. So I imagine there'll be some challenges. And like Quinn said, I'm very curious about, you know, how much she'll be able to get done. The mayor certainly made a statement by creating this position and appointing her to it. But I look at some of those first-time jobs, positions like that, and how much are they actually able to accomplish? Because folks aren't necessarily ready for them.
It's worth noting, too, this position is being funded in part by the Chicago Funders Together to End Homelessness. It's a philanthropic support for this position. To be effective, you've got to be able to work with the philanthropic community, so that's a real advantage. Will be an advantage as she defines this new role. But as with J.B. Pritzker paying his staff out of his own pocket in addition to their salaries, it does raise questions about, like, whom are you serving? I hope it's clear to her that she's got to be serving the mayor, who is her boss, and not get too confused by other input she might be having.
Yeah. Let's turn now to the city council, Brandis. There was drama involving Alderman Byron Sigcho Lopez this week. Drama.
When is there ever not drama? Mm-hmm. Occasionally they get away with being kind of drama-free.
I haven't seen it.
I mean, let's be honest. Some of us kind of live for it. Like, there's a Garrett's downstairs. Let's get some popcorn and talk about city council. there was a measure that was rejected in city council earlier this week to punish Alderman Byron Sigcho Lopez. Last week he spoke at a protest where I think it was before he spoke, and Sigcho Lopez was not aware that this had happened before he spoke, that a Marine Corps veteran, Zachary Cam, burned a flag at the protest. Obviously, a lot of aldermen very upset over, you know, there were images that were shown of him speaking, and there ended up being a lot of confusion about what actually happened and what the alderman said. And so, you know.
And fill us in on what you know. I mean, who was at this March 23rd protest, and where was the flag burned exactly?
So I'm not 100% clear on where the flag was burned, but the protesters were calling for an end to the war in Gaza. They were also denouncing President Joe Biden. They were saying that the Democratic National Convention should not be held in Chicago in August when that happens. So there was that, right? But then at the city council meeting this week, Zachary Cam, he tried to speak, but he had not signed up and won the lottery to be able to speak. And I think it was Alderwoman Maria Haddon suggesting to her colleagues that they are careful about what they tweet and what they say and you know, a lot of the back and forth. And so, you know, the measure to remove him from, what was his position as chair of the housing committee?
Yeah, housing and real estate, I believe.
Yeah. That one failed by 16 to 29. So, there's...
Well, let's hear from the man himself. In a passionate speech on Monday, the alderman both apologized while defending the veteran for exercising his First Amendment rights.
That if in any way, shape, or form, my actions have offended anyone, especially veterans, I'll take full accountability. But not once, by no means, I'm going to condemn a veteran for using his First Amendment right.
So he's not going to blame a veteran for using his First Amendment right, but that's not how many of the elders saw it.
Well,
right?
I think, you know, there was the flag burning, and then there was the group itself and who these people are. And I think after the initial flag burning pushback, the kind of focus of the criticism went against this, the group of protesters and some things they were calling for, ending the DNC or not having the DNC here, calling Joe Biden Genocide Joe for the U.S.'s support of Israel. And I think, you know, criticizing American empire, you know, pretty, you know, interesting criticisms. And I think, you know, some aldermen were offended or said they were offended by some of this, you know, this rhetoric. But I do think that they, was this really about what happened, or was this about trying to take down Byron Sixto Lopez, an ally of the mayor, a very outspoken alderman? You know, I think the sharks smelled blood here, and they thought maybe they could score some political points. And, you know, I don't know if they did. The measure failed pretty decisively.
Yeah, the vote and the public comments were pretty raucous, including, you know, Sixto Lopez was called a traitor, right?
He was. And, you know, it really kind of devolved on social media, which is how it kind of started. You know, a few people tweeted images of this, and then just kind of a really intense back and forth that, as Maria had noted, spilled over into city council. And, in that message, she said, hey, we all have cell phones. Like, did we really have to have a whole city council meeting to deal with this? Couldn't we have iron this out? And Chris Taliaferro, who, you know, kind of sponsored this or was part of it, he said on the council floor that he actually sat down with Sixto Lopez and they came to a kind of understanding.
Yeah.
And he's actually not going to support this anymore. So Goodness. Maybe that could have happened without any of this playing out in the public eye. I don't know.
David, do you see the defeat of this resolution as a win for the council's progressive caucus?
Well, I would say so. And it's also interesting if you compare it to the Carlos Romero Sorosa somewhat similar situation, different situation, but also a vote of repudiation by the council against one of its members, in which the mayor actually had to step in. It was a 24-24 tie. Mayor had to step in and save his ally, although he had Ramirez Rosa had to give up his floor leader position, which was very significant. In this case, yes, it was a resounding save. Sixto stays in his position. The vote was so strong. Yeah, I think it's an effective pushback against the resistance saying, no, what he did, yeah, maybe he made a mistake. Maybe he should have known the flag was burned if he really didn't know, et cetera. But It comes, I think, progressive caucus. You got to score it as a win.
So what are your thoughts right now then, David, on the atmosphere overall at city council and how this international story that both Brandis and Quinn mentioned, the war in Gaza, how it's having its local impact at city hall?
Well, the war in Gaza has become a dominating issue within city council politics, which is quite interesting because I'm not sure the stake of the Chicago City Council per se in that issue. But it does show the fractiousness of what's going on in council right now and fractiousness within council and viewpoints, not to mention the public's interaction, which the Gaza protesting has led to the mayor to very mistakenly at one point really try to basically limit public access to council meetings and such. And it does show also this political change, this progressive caucus flexing its muscles and even not always being completely allied with the mayor, as we saw with after the loss on the Bring Chicago Home referendum, the progressive caucus saying, you know, maybe we've made some mistakes. Maybe we haven't been communicating very effectively about what we would have done with this extra $100 million a year or something, which is absolutely completely off the script of what the mayor was saying after that loss. And so it's a topsy-turvy kind of mixed up world at city council these days.
Goodness. All right. Well, let's stick with city council, Quinn. Let's talk about a measure that advanced that would let alders decide whether to use ShotSpotter technology in their wards. Get us up to speed
on
that. Sure.
ShotSpotter, back in the news. It seems to never go away, huh?
No, it does. A gift that keeps on giving.
Won't even leave the neighborhoods, it turns out.
Yeah, seriously. Well, so this is the gunshot detection technology that Chicago has used, I believe, in about 12 police districts, mostly on the south and west sides. It's pretty controversial. It's supported by police, many police, and many neighbors, honestly, who see it as a unique tool to bring police to neighborhoods where there may not be 911 calls, that sort of thing. But it has a lot of criticism over its efficacy. Is it worth spending all this money? And it has there have been some reports that show it's maybe not as effective as the city and the company certainly would like it to be. So, you know, Mayor Brandon Johnson promised on the campaign trail to do away with the ShotSpotter contract. He did, after a kind of extended political situation this winter, did do away with it, said we're going to extend it. And then actually we're going to extend it a little more because they didn't necessarily have the contract lined up. It was kind of a kerfuffle, I would say. Mm-hmm. Anyway, long story short, it's supposed to go away. It's still on track, perhaps, to go away later this fall. But older people, even Brandon Johnson's supporters, a lot of them on the South and West Sides really like ShotSpotter. Pat Dowell, Chris Taliaferro, who mm-hmm. is his police and fire chair, Jason Irvin, they all spoke at this hearing on Monday in support of creating some kind of measure to basically give control of ShotSpotter to city council. I talked to the sponsor, Alderman David Moore, and he basically said this measure is to force a vote, a city council vote, on whether or not we should keep ShotSpotter.
Yeah.
And also provide a whole slew of reporting data. You know, can we get more information about how this is actually working on the neighborhood level? So, you know, it's interesting. I don't know how that's going to work as on the, like a contracting
and that
situation.
Forced vote that's happening this month.
It is likely to happen this month. It passed committee on Monday unanimously, the Police and Fire Committee, which is, I think, tying in with the Sixto Lopez thing that, and some other city council stuff, it is kind of this, you know, pretty open challenge to the mayor's agenda from some of his allies.
Yeah.
You know, the whole point of putting your allies in committee chairs is so that you can quash legislation that challenges your agenda, right? And here we have a committee advancing to a full city council vote, something that is diametrically opposed to what Brandon Johnson says he wants. So I think that is kind of the interesting takeaway. I don't know specifically how this is going to work out, how they could pay for it on a ward-by-ward level. You know, ShotSpotter is also on a police district level, not a ward level.
Right.
So there are all the specifics that I'm confused about still.
Yeah, we're all
but
confused.
Just the fact that it advanced this far is kind of remarkable to me.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. I mean, is this measure advancing a blow for Johnson, you think, David?
Well, certainly. In a way. I mean, his campaign position was get rid of ShotSpotter. He actually did it. He had to bring it back because of the convention. And what's confusing here is that the data so far in support of ShotSpotter just isn't there. There's a couple of inspector general reports out about it. Kim Fox herself has said it really doesn't help with law enforcement. The defense in the communities where they're defending it is, well, it's not really about like bringing criminal charges against shooters. It's because a victim might not otherwise get help in time. And yet they've offered no data of saying victims are helped in time. And so he's sort of caught between what he promised to do when he was campaigning and probably now really realizing, yeah, actually, this is kind of an effective tool, and there's a lot more support for it in the city than I realize. So it may well be that these people are actually helping him. I don't really know at the end of the day if we gave him some truth serum and said, Mayor Johnson, do you or do you not want ShotSpotter? I'm not sure what is
right. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, like, his superintendent, Snelling, has said that he supports ShotSpotter law enforcement.
Oh, wholeheartedly.
Often, yes, right. Wholeheartedly. Law enforcement, you know, they often argue that, you know, the ShotSpotter will detect something that a victim may not have actually phoned in, right? So that that the police are getting information about a shot fired that the community may not have called in. But, you know, the other flip side of that is the criticism of the sort of heightened alert and the mm-hmm. heightened awareness that police officers go into a scene with after they've gotten a ShotSpotter detection,
right,
as we all know in the Adam Toledo very tragic and unfortunate case. The other question I have here, is ShotSpotter going to go for another contract change? Like, do they have whiplash over there?
That's true. Let's talk to somebody from ShotSpotter.
Well, yeah.
What's their new name now?
Sound Thinking. I did reach out to their PR people, and I didn't hear back from them.
I'm sure
they still want money from the city of Chicago. So, you know, but yes, there was that the whole contract extension in February
might they be willing to renegotiate a sort of ward by ward, very complicated police district by police district ShotSpotter system? Also, is that fair? Like, the way it is right now, ShotSpotter is only in certain communities, and I think the police department has made the case that those are the communities that need it. But if all communities need it, and we're only going to give it to some communities, mm-hmm. does that sound like the right thing to do?
There's also an interesting precedent here with, like, ward by ward. Is the funding, as Quinn pointed out, it gets really complicated. This is part of this broader effort of council to be more independent from the mayor of the city of Chicago and exercise its own agenda in ways that historically city council has not done. And it's a sign of the mayor's weakness as a leader, possibly.
Yeah.
But it is also a sign of a surging move on the part of council to define its own agenda.
All right. Well, let's move on from this shot spotter mess. Folks, it took 10 days of counting ballots. We finally got a winner in the Cook County State's Attorney race. Eileen O'Neill Burke stressed that it was her law and order message that led to victory. Let's listen.
People told me everywhere they want to be able to go out at night and not be worried. They want to ride on a safe public transportation system. People want illegal guns and assault weapons off of our streets. Those are all things we all want.
O'Neill Burke narrowly won against Clayton Harris, who had the backing of the Cook County Democratic Party. So, Quinn, your thoughts on how she won and how Democrats are now reacting?
Wow. Well, what a close race. 1,500 votes.
Yeah, that was tight.
One of the closest races in recent memory. And I wrote so many stories over the 10 days of, well, we don't have a winner.
Oh, I bet.
Clayton Harris has narrowed his lead just a little bit, but O'Neill Burke is still winning. So, you know, when it was called on Friday, I breathed a sigh of relief, not for the winner, just so that I could stop writing about it for now. but yeah, so, you know.
Sigh of relief for you.
Exactly, for myself. I thought it was really interesting that she's, you know, kind of touting her law and order bona fides there. Well, also, in, you know, saying in her kind of victory speech this week and in an interview I did with her, you know, it's not right to call me tough on crime. She's trying to kind of walk that line. I find that a little curious, but because I certainly think the way that she won over voters and beat the Cook County Democratic Party, who endorsed Clayton Harris, is by being the tough on crime law and order candidate in that race. You know, in the grand scheme of things, is she that person? If you know, I don't know, but certainly compared to Clayton Harris, that was how she modeled herself. Mm-hmm. And you know, we talked about the retail theft threshold. She wants to lower that to $300, although said there would be some exceptions and some nuance there. And so, yeah, I think she pounded that message, and I think for us, you know, she won the suburbs pretty handily. And then for Chicago voters, where Clayton Harris did win, but she did win a good number of votes. I do think that people over the past year have seen a spike in robberies, you know, seen other crime that has not gone down. So I do think that that resonated with Chicago voters
sure.
as well. And so I think that's how she cobbled this together.
Yeah. Any thoughts on this race, Brandis?
I, too, am glad that it is over. And, I mean, shout out to Quinn Myers over here also. Just we were
right.
talking about this in the green room and, like, the number
like,
of stories that
he has
written.
How did you figure out a new headline for every story?
Or new photos. We had to keep
new
swapping
photos,
in
new
ones.
Lead.
Hopefully you've got good copy editors.
A new lead. We still don't know.
I'll be, you know, like, if, you know, if she, of course, goes on to the general and then should win the position, I will be curious to see. I think, you know, in the last, you know, 8 years of the Kim Fox term, we have seen a progressive prosecutor, right? Like, you know, taking, for example, the $300, and we keep talking about this a lot, right? Like the $300 threshold at which to prosecute retail theft crime, Kim Fox raising that to $1,000 before she'll, you know, prosecuting those that are under $1,000 as a misdemeanor instead of a felony. That's just one example, you know, of sort of a progressive move and a prosecutor sort of taking matters into their own hands with regards to, you know, how much are we locking people up?
Yeah.
And so I will be curious, because like you said, Quinn, you know, she's sort of walking back the I'm not tough on crime, which, again, I do, because even in that clip that you just played, there's some tough on crime messaging
yes,
there
absolutely.
Versus restorative justice, though she says that she believes in restorative justice programming as well because she has seen them work. So I'll be curious that if she gets elected, I'll be curious to see how much of that she implements.
And I do think, I mean, I think her and Clayton Harris, I don't actually know how different they were as candidates. I think they had to draw some lines to try to win over voters. Mm-hmm. I think that's what happened. But, you know, I actually don't know how different they're. Policies and platforms
right.
were in this campaign.
They probably weren't very. All right, let's steer the conversation over to the financial district in the loop. David, the mayor is moving forward with plans to turn office buildings into residential units, right?
Right. And the import of this for us as residents of the city is 5 million square feet of empty commercial space in the city right now. This is going to eliminate about 25% of that huge overhang, which is a big problem for landlords and just what it's like to be downtown Chicago these days. It still feels relatively empty mm-hmm. compared to what it was pre-COVID. Well, you put, you know, basically 1.5 2.5 million square feet of residential space in what is now just empty office space. And you are beginning to create a new community, and you're beginning to change the feel of what it's like to be downtown in the financial district.
Yeah.
And so there's four major projects. Three of these were already well in the works under Mayor Lori Lightfoot, but there's definite progress here. And what's interesting is that Mayor Brandon Johnson, who ran against TIFs, tax increment financing, which favors developers as part of his campaign for mayor, is pulling out the old TIF toolkit and applying it quite ambitiously towards these projects. It's going to go into basically right on LaSalle. It literally is LaSalle Street, and it's going to become kind of a new neighborhood. And it's going to happen pretty much on a fast track. The idea is to get it done, to construction to really begin as soon as all the financing can be put in place. And so within a couple years, really within this mayor's term, we may be seeing people move in. And the big part about it is that a third of these units are really earmarked for people earning less than, as a couple of two, earning less than $56,000 a year, or about $56,000 a year. So this is not going to just become an elite community, which you might expect going to the financial district, and what an awesome place it would be to live. And one of the things that was said at the press conference was, like, the janitor who finished his work at 2 a.m. can walk home from work in LaSalle Street. And anybody who's been late downtown and seen people kind of hopping buses to who knows where, living somewhere elsewhere,
it
speaks to the kind of the progressive impulse behind all this. It could be a great thing for the city.
And a continuation of Lori Lightfoot's legacy, perhaps, who, you know, first kind of muscled this in before, you know, losing the mayor's race. So it'll be interesting. You know, I loved that line in Heather Sharone's piece about it, where she said the buildings are beloved but little used historic landmarks. And that's really true on LaSalle Street. You know, you walk past some of the most beautiful buildings in Chicago, but there's like no one on the street. So hopefully this is a shot in the arm that the area needs.
Yeah. Well, I want to stick with Brandon Johnson for a moment. This week actually marked the 1 year anniversary of his election. I think it's actually today. So I just wanted to get all your thoughts on how this year has gone real quickly. But Quinn, I know that you actually interviewed the mayor this week. So what did he say about his first year?
Well, you know, I put a line in my story that he expressed almost unbridled confidence in his tenure, which I think came through in, you know, some of the quotes that I put in there. You know, I wanted to know if this was a moment of political reset for him after a pretty, you know, contentious first year, a lot of opponents coming out, as well as some allies criticizing him over the migrant crisis, over his broader agenda, over the defeat of Bring Chicago Home. We talked already about the faction city council that seems, you know, dedicated to undoing or everything that he has tried to do. And he remained pretty defined. He said, "Name one thing I haven't done, you're not gonna." And of course, there are some things, you know. But, you know, I think
Quinn can rise to that challenge.
There are some, especially some of the, some maybe less sexy campaign promises, which he hasn't gotten to. Notably, Bring Chicago Home did not pass, which was a key campaign pledge. But I think, you know, what I wanted to do in the piece was showcase his attitude now, of, or at least the message he's trying to get out there, which is we're rolling, you know, we're going on with our agenda. And as he said a few weeks ago, buckle up. So I think that is the message that him and his team are trying to get out there.
I don't know whether to be excited or scared. Do you have quick thoughts, Brandis and David, on year one?
Bumpy, you know, obviously, like he's taking
buckle up.
Exactly. Well, I'm curious to see what the next few years look like and you know, how he can recover, because I think it has been a bumpy year for him. But I appreciate the confidence, Mayor,
for sure.
And Quinn's interview story was excellent. I think in every respect, except for maybe there were two useful quotes. And that's not because of the interviewing. It's because this is a mayor who is still working from his campaign sloganeering and has yet to really engage with kind of running the city day to day and explaining to the people what he's up to. And that's one of the reasons that Bring Chicago Home failed. And it's one of the reasons that he really can't create meaningful connections with a lot of constituencies, especially sort of the business establishment that really feels like this mayor just doesn't know them, doesn't understand them, doesn't seem to want to work with them. And when he has met with them, those old bromides from the campaign just do not work. They want to get together with people who, like Lori Lightfoot, like Rahm Emanuel, who, when you got in a room and tried to work out a problem, you could actually, like, talk turkey and get business done.
Yeah.
And he needs to step into that, really own this role as the chief executive of the city of Chicago.
Let's turn to state politics, Brandis. Republicans have proposed legislation to overhaul the state's prisoner review board. It follows, of course, that tragic killing of an 11-year-old boy. Give us the details.
Yeah, I mean, in that case, obviously, tragic, as you said, breaks my heart. We've been playing video of 11-year-old Jaden Perkins. He was a dancer. My own son is 11 years old. I was a dancer. So a very tragic case there. And, like, none of those other, you know, affinities have to matter. We all agree. So Crossetti Brand was incarcerated in prison. He was out on mandatory supervised release. He allegedly violated that. There was a hearing before the Illinois Prisoner Review Board to decide whether or not to revoke that release, which it is not parole, which a lot of folks in Illinois don't know. We don't actually have parole in the sense that most people are used to it existing, though we do have a little bit of parole. Different story entirely. The board decided that it did not have the authority to revoke his release. He was released on March 12th. Jaden Perkins was dead on March 13th. And so Republicans, in response, believe that there needs to be a lot of reform at the board, because the other thing that happened at the Prisoner Review Board is the chair resigned, as well as Leanne Miller, one of the board members who was on that three board member panel who voted on the Brand case. So it gets fairly, you know, complicated. After that, we interviewed the Illinois Prisoner Review Board chair, the former chair, Donald Shelton, on Black Voices.
You had an exclusive.
We did have that exclusive,
Did he say why he resigned?
He did. A couple of reasons. One of them was it's sort of old school, you know, captain of the ship. I am responsible for what happens and the outcomes of the decisions that are made on this board. And therefore, you know, when a tragedy, you know, something like this goes so very wrong, I, you know, am taking responsibility and stepping down for partly for that reason, because he also says that he trained a number of the members of the board as well. But his second reasoning got a little bit more political. Governor Pritzker released a statement about the resignation of Leanne Miller. And in his statement, the governor, you know, alleged that the domestic violence victim or victims were not given the consideration that they need and that they deserve. And Shelton did not agree with that assessment and with that sort of faulting or fault finding of Leanne Miller, in that he believes that the board, she and the other panel members, made a good faith decision on the Brand case, and they could not have anticipated that the murder that was going to happen was going to happen. They looked at the facts and the law and the state's responsibility in that case, and they did not feel that they could revoke his release. And so that was part of his reasoning as well as what he told us on the show.
I want to squeeze in another story here with you, Brandis. Illinois lawmakers are also asking questions about the governor's proposal to consolidate early childhood programs. What are their concerns exactly?
So their concerns are, obviously, the governor is asking for, I believe it's about $13.1 million in this proposed budget for the upcoming fiscal year to fund the new Department of Early Childhood, as you mentioned. And the governor's office says that would cover some initial startup costs, hiring staff, you know, computers, software licenses, that kind of thing. So get going.
Yeah.
But concern, there's concern about whether or not this is just going to create a new bureaucracy. How much more money is this going to cost? And how is that money going to be spent? And is that money that could otherwise be spent directly on the services that need to be provided to early learning and to young children?
And David, state lawmakers continue to work on Illinois' pension problems. What's the latest?
Well, some bills were moved out of committee on the House side just this week with regard to fixing what's called Tier 2 of the pension system. That's the biggest pension issue that needs to be addressed pretty quickly, which is that the Tier 2, which was created in 2011 to reduce the state's pension costs, maybe is not adequate, legally speaking, and that the growth in benefits is not matching the growth in Social Security benefits, which the pension system is legally obligated to do.
Yeah.
So there needs to be a fix. In the meanwhile, the governor in his budget put forward a sweeping plan to overhaul pensions and really fix them. This Illinois has the worst funded pension system in the country, $142 billion worth of pension debt. And Governor Pritzker's proposal over a number of years through 2048 would get us to 100% funding. That is being discussed. There's a hearing on it, and I don't think that it'll come to a vote during this session, but it could come to a vote in the fall or in the lame duck session early next year, which would be a remarkable political moment, because nothing's been done on pensions in the state of Illinois since at least 2013, when the state Supreme Court rejected the last effort to fix the state's pensions. Mm-hmm.
Now, before we take a break, folks, Cook County Clerk Karen Yarbrough is in the hospital for what's being called a serious medical condition. We have no more details than that, unfortunately, but our thoughts are with her and as well her family. Now, people in Logan Square, Quinn, they think that they may have come up with one way to curb the late night parties.
One way, yes.
One way. One of your block club colleagues covered this. Fill us in.
Yes, our steadfast Logan Square reporter, Ariel Perella. This is what I would call a classic block club story, a very hyper-local neighborhood story. On a certain block of Richmond Street in Logan Square, just south of Logan Boulevard between Milwaukee Avenue, there have been, you know, basically a whole series of public parties, issues with people urinating in the alley, coming out of these bars, essentially, on Milwaukee Avenue. And so neighbors are really fed up. They're pissed off. Another unintentional pun there, I guess. But so Ariel talked to them, and she talked to Alderman Daniel Espada. And so one solution here is maybe to turn Richmond into a one-way going the other way, so people might not be able to drive right off of Milwaukee where all the bars are and park there. You know, some neighbors like that idea, others saying it's not good enough. But I think it's an interesting tactic, and I've seen it done with a couple different parking bans, also in the First Ward, as kind of these non-police responses to, you know, rowdiness and people who are maybe not being, you know, committing crimes, but are really causing a public nuisance. So we'll see how it works out.
Yeah. So we have to pivot now to some sad news here at WBEZ, a story very close to my heart, of course. Some of you may have noticed that Chicago Public Media, that we also made headlines this week for the same thing that lots of media outlets have been struggling with, especially lately, and that's financial problems. 14 of our colleagues here at WBEZ and the Chicago Sun-Times and Vocalo were laid off. David, I know that you've done a lot of work looking into the challenges. As I said, this has been happening. This has been facing our media industry. And I'm hoping that you can sort of join me in this here and sort of share what you've learned and include that tidbit that you've written about, which is a state task force examining how to help local news survive.
Right. This is a symptom of a national problem that is affecting not just our access to news and coverage of news, but also just the very fabric of our democracy. And despite these layoffs, and it's very unfortunate that some people had to lose their jobs, but this is against the headwinds of the broken business model of journalism. And what's going on at BEZ and the Sun-Times is one effort of several here in the city to fix that broken business model. And a few years ago, $61 million of philanthropic support was put behind this effort.
Yeah.
And the BEZ and Sun-Times are trying to figure out their model, just like Block Club is building from the ground up an incredible and successful model that's being watched nationally.
Mm-hmm.
The BGA is a nonprofit, and we raise money, and we're trying a new journalism initiative that focuses on solutions journalism in addition to our traditional investigative reporting. So these are growing pains, or saving the industry pains, that sometimes happen. The statewide task force is very important because it has proposed a series of measures that would help bring money not just to in the city, but statewide.
Yeah.
Illinois has really been affected. 86% of journalism jobs in Illinois have disappeared over the last 10 years.
Really?
Nationally, 30% of the newspapers have shut down during that time period.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what we're up against. And so this task force is proposing all kinds of tax credits for subscriptions, tax credits for hiring journalists. They're proposing that community foundations could perhaps buy newspapers, et cetera. So the fixes are coming. Kind of, we're fixing it as we try to keep riding it. And unfortunately, not every move works. Vocalo, unfortunately, a great experiment, just couldn't quite build the audience it needed to be sustainable. And the people who run organizations like ours are going to have to just keep experimenting. And hopefully the public support will continue to get us through this period. The good news for Chicagoans is this ecosystem here in Chicago, this news ecosystem, is the strongest in the country. The experimentation going on here is unlike anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And so against this sad news event, we should at least be grateful that people are trying. And I will give compliments. The Sun-Times WBEZ coverage, Dave McKinney's coverage of this story, was an exceptionally balanced and smart story covering all the bases, the best story written on it. And one thing that you have to do is maintain trust in your readership. And a story like that lets people know, hey, we're on the job. We're going to keep covering all the news, including the news about ourselves.
Listen, I am grieving with my colleagues. I miss them. I will miss them dearly. It's unfortunate. Everything that you're saying, David, though, is true, right? It's a harsh reality. At the end of the day, these are human beings who are extremely talented, and I'm hoping for nothing but the best for their futures here or beyond. Quinn, you had thoughts?
Just thought that Dave's story was great and a masterclass on how to report on your own news organization, which is always extremely tricky.
Yeah.
But I thought it raised some really important and still unanswered questions about CPM's finances, executive pay, that sort of thing.
Yeah. All right. A lot of the news so far has been about as gloomy as that weather outside of our windows. So I think it's time to take a look on the bright side. Shall we?
It's getting better, too. I think I see some blue sky out there.
Yeah. I haven't seen outside.
And that's firsthand reporting from some first-rate journalists.
Firsthand reporting.
We went from world-class journalists to first-rate journalists.
I think both things can be true.
Okay, all right. That's true.
Both things can be. Yes, okay. And, David.
Yes, and.
So, okay, let's start out this good news section with news that has classical music lovers celebrating. So after a multi-year global search, the CSO, the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, announced that its next conductor and musical director will be 28-year-old Finnish conductor Klaus Makkala. And when he takes over the podium in 2027, he'll be the youngest ever music director in the history of the CSO. That's pretty darn cool.
It's a real change for the history of this orchestra, which has kind of been, that job has been kind of a career achievement award. George Schulte, Daniel Barenboim, Ricardo Muti. These are people who would establish themselves as global maestros. And now we've got somebody under 30 running the CSO. That's quite interesting.
I love it. I love it. All right. Other good news. For the first time in 100 years, the Chicago River will soon be open for swimming. 500 swimmers are taking part in the Chicago River Swim on September 22nd. Have you all signed up? I'm sure you have.
I am maybe open to it. I swim in the lake a lot. And yes, there's a significant difference between the lake and the river.
I was like, who's going to tell him?
But I do think I would possibly be open to trying it. I would want a shower nearby, right afterwards, or maybe like a chemical wash or something. But I'm not against it. And I think if it brings attention to the river ecosystem, that is probably a good thing.
Doesn't this seem like a remarkable environmental milestone, though? Are we missing that point?
It does sound like that, right? But I mean, Quinn's got more faith than I do. I'm not that big on swimming. I can swim. I'm not swimming in the lake unless I'm at the beach necessarily. But like Quinn said, I hope this does, sort of draw attention to the environment of the river and improvements that have been made, but also improvements that remain.
Do you think the river is safe to swim in, David?
I go back to the original Mayor Daley saying one day people will be fishing and eating from the river. And I guess maybe swimming for a little while with your mouth closed, you could do it. We've got a ways to go, but it's amazing. When I see people out kayaking on the river and just the way with the Riverwalk, the way the river has become a centerpiece of the city.
Mm-hmm.
And it used to just kind of stink to be near the river. So we're definitely making progress.
Listen, we're now a source of inspiration for other cities who may be looking to clean up their waterways.
Or put floating hot tubs. What happened to the hot tubs? Did we ever get an update on the hot tub
still around?
Were people actually doing that?
Yes, they were.
Take off?
I believe they were.
Talking to you, friends at Axios. They sure were.
All right, more good news. 4 Chicago restaurants are finalists for the prestigious James Beard Award. I hope I'm saying all these right. Lula Cafe. Mm-hmm. Anna Posey of Elska, and Sujan Sarkar of Indian, and Jenner Tomaska of Esme are competing for Best Chef Great Lakes. So congratulations.
Congratulations
Huge
to them.
Congratulations.
Yeah, yeah. I just want to say I'm disappointed that the bear didn't make the list. I thought that the bear would have maybe been up there.
It's not
I have to try
real.
Some of these. I mean, Lula is a favorite. I think everyone loves Lula. And
everyone loves Lula.
Outstanding hospitality, that makes total sense if you've ever dine there. But I haven't gone to any of these other spots.
I've been to Esme. The problem with when these folks get nominated, and congrats to them, it's very very exciting is you cannot get a reservation to those places
That's
anymore.
The
other thing that I thought was interesting, and I noticed this last year as well, the Best Chef Great Lakes category, it's gotten more diverse regionally. There were previous years where they were dominated. All five nominations or all five finalists were Chicago chefs.
Oh,
and
wow.
This year, we've got, it's mixed up. Mm-hmm. They're from the other states in the region, Indiana
the
and
other places.
Michigan and the other, you know, anything outside of Chicago.
Okay. Well, the James Beard Awards,
to them.
It'll be held in Chicago again this year, the awards at the Lyric Opera House on June 10th. So look out for that. Final good news story that I'll share this week. Grammy winning songwriter Che Rhymefest Smith made headlines announcing that he's running for a seat on Chicago's first elected school board. He's hoping to represent the 10th district, which spans from Bronzeville through Hyde Park and the South Shore to the southern border of the city. And folks may remember this isn't the first time he's run for elected office. He ran for alderman in 2011, so we'll see what happens. He's running against a former principal.
And I believe he sang at his campaign launch this week. I believe there was a musical performance.
He sang.
There was some kind of performance.
Sang, not rapped. Okay.
You know, kudos to them. So I think, I mean, big picture, that's going to be a really interesting citywide thing.
Yeah.
Watching these races, who gets involved and who's paying for these
Absolutely.
Races, charters, CTU, et cetera.
Yeah, that's it for the weekly news recap. We'll leave it there. My thanks to Quinn Myers of Block Club Chicago, WTTW's Brandis Friedman, and David Greising of the Better Government Association. Thanks all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Andrea Guthman, and it was mixed and edited by Meha Ahmed. The news cycle moves fast, so our weekly news recap gives us the opportunity to slow it down. If you enjoy our recap as much as we do, well, consider leaving us a rating and liking this podcast. It helps us share these stories with more people in and around the city. Thanks for listening, and have a restful weekend.
Have you ever wondered why anyone drinks Malort? Or if there are actually lobsters in the Chicago River? Then listen to the Curious City podcast, where we answer all your questions about Chicago and the region. WBEZ's Curious City is part of the NPR network and available wherever you find your podcasts.